acceptance with the rule of the law, it could tear apart social harmony in a diverse country like India, which has a remarkable history of communal violence. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Hundreds attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. They came to drum up support, especially for female Palestinian prisoners who have been subjected to inhumane and oppressive measures inside Israeli prisons and detention centers. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners. Hamas movement accused the Israeli prison service of deliberately targeting female prisoners and endangering their lives.
We are witnessing a Friday of rage all over Palestine to support prisoners who are languishing inside Zionist jails. The Palestinian people will not sit idle while female prisoners are being humiliated and beaten by the Zionist captors. We hold the Zionist regime fully responsible for the lives of the female prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Palestinian female prisoners continue to face a wide range of human rights violations in Israeli jails, under the watchful eye of the international community.
Attacking female prisoners and placing them in solitary confinement is cruel and inhumane. Nowadays, all prisoners are suffering, especially during the cold winter season, and we call on the Red Cross to exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its illegal practices against the prisoners. We also demand an international investigation team to probe Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Israel currently incarcerates some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners, including scores of women and children. Palestinian prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers under the administration of the Israeli Prison Service.
Female Palestinian prisoners are facing unprecedented attacks inside Israeli jails, and these attacks are taking place on a daily basis. Any attack on Palestinian female prisoners is an attack on all Palestinians. As we stand here, we warn the Israeli regime that it must immediately stop such attacks against female prisoners.
Many Palestinian prisoners also suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment. Thousands of Palestinian prisoners are currently languishing inside Israeli jails. Securing their release is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In January 2020, a little less than 2 years ago, the UK officially left the European Union. After years of political wrangling, it was finally time for the British government to live up to its Brexit pledges. So what were they?
When it comes to the economy, the British government has made flowery promises. Tariff-free trade with the EU with minimum bureaucracy. £350 million that would have been given to Brussels, given to the NHS instead. Higher wages for all, and new trade deals, and access to a European trading zone from Iceland to Russia. So how is that going? We asked British investment manager and business commentator Justin Stewart if any of these pledges have come to fruition.
We are all very confused, but most people would say that actually the government has not made good on its arrangements for exiting the EU, other than the fact they've gone through with the exit. But we haven't had the rest of the agreement. Fishing, farming, finance regulations, all those elements are still up in the air.
And there was another promise worth mentioning, a VAT cut on energy bills that would save the average household £64 a year. Well, as of spring 2022, people might see their energy bills double due to an unexpected energy crisis. So what happened there?
What they wanted to do was have more power companies enter the market, so there was more competition, which is a good idea. However, if the quality of the companies themselves didn't really understand the market, then actually when the price started going up, these companies were made of nothing. They had no experience, didn't understand how to buy forward pricing of oil and gas. And so when the price went up very strongly indeed, they weren't in a position to actually try and look after their customers or even their business. And so they went bust.
And as a result of higher energy prices, the Centre for Economics and Business Research predicts in 2022, a typical UK family will spend £1,700 more per year on household costs, with the inflation rate rising to its highest in a decade.
It's going to be hard for people to live. It will. Especially the elderly. Yeah, all right, they may get a pension, but that's nothing.
We were just commenting, just coming down here now, the price of petrol still hasn't gone back down again. You know, it seems once it's gone up, it's just continuing.
It's not just, I'm already worried about it because we can see there's lots of problems with energy companies that are going bust, and my own did as well, and it's been transferred, and I've seen the prices and they are astronomical.
These are hard times in Britain, with Brexit-related fuel, food and retail delivery shortages leaving more than half the British population feeling Brexit is going badly. But in the press, it's not all doom and gloom. The BBC says the UK economy is set to grow at its fastest rate in more than 70 years. The Telegraph says British growth has surpassed China for the first time in 40 years. And according to The Express, the UK economy is set to outperform every Eurozone nation with double the growth of Germany. So what do the experts say about such forecasts?
Yes, of course, you're going to see an immediate bounce back in the economy because that's what happens when you shut it down. It bounces back. The key element happens after that. Where does the sustained growth come from? And what you're talking about now from the Chancellor and the government saying a 6% growth next year and thereafter, no, that's not going to happen. It's going to be a much, much slower level of growth and probably in the region of maybe 2, 3%, something like that. So what you've got the government doing is talking up the economy, and you can understand why they want to try and do it, because they want to try and increase confidence.
Are big businesses confident to stay and operate in the UK? Are Britons confident to start up their own small businesses and keep the wheels of the economy turning? Only time will tell.
Of course, we cannot ignore the fact that we are still in the grips of a global pandemic. Tens of thousands of people have died in the UK as a result of COVID-19, even though it was the first country to start vaccinating. Lockdown after lockdown have taken their toll, and now we have the new Omicron variant.
The hospitality industry is reeling from the government's mixed messages over Omicron ahead of Christmas. It's forecast to lose £300 million worth of trade over the holidays, and some businesses have decided to close already due to staffing issues, cancellations, and an overall downturn in trade. So for them, this comes far too late in the day.
We don't think today that there is enough evidence to justify any tougher measures before Christmas.
According to the OECD, the British economy is recovering and expected to reach pre-crisis levels at the beginning of 2022. But growth will rely primarily on household spending. The average family spends 29% more in the weeks before Christmas. And that might be why, despite Omicron, the government has chosen to accelerate the booster jab rollout and not cancel Christmas. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As millions of Yemenis face the threat of drowning into a famine due to the ongoing Saudi-led war on the country, the World Food Programme says it will reduce its food rations to 8 million people in Yemen starting next month due to a lack of funding.
What the World Food Programme's done is a clear escalation against civilians and will primarily harm children and women who depend on humanitarian aid for their survival. The United Nations bears full responsibility because it's primarily responsible for humanitarian aid and it's supposed to protect civilians, not help international political forces to impose pressure on Yemenis.
The United Nations warned that the shortage of funds will hamper the assistance it provides to 13 million Yemenis, including thousands of children suffering from acute malnutrition.
The announcement by the World Food Programme to reduce food aid provided to 8 million people is to continue to blackmail the Yemeni people and the political leadership and pressure them to yield more and make more concessions in favor of the coalition of aggression. And unfortunately, the international community is complicit in this aggression. This act will cause a major humanitarian catastrophe since the aid reaches only a very small number of people and most of the money earned by international organizations goes to operate expenses of the organizations themselves and not to the needy.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in 2015, millions of Yemenis have been depending on humanitarian assistance to survive. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Observers say the lives of millions of Yemenis remain in danger unless the international community takes real measures to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it imposes on Yemen. Despite ongoing humanitarian assistance, the world body says 16.2 million people in Yemen remain food insecure. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
President Vladimir Putin has talked about Moscow's security proposals presented to the NATO alliance last week. Speaking during his annual press conference, he said it is the Western countries that must immediately give Russia security guarantees, not the other way around.
They told us in the 1990s, not an inch to the east. What is the result? They cheated us. They simply impudently cheated us with NATO's five waves of expansion. Now the corresponding systems are already appearing in Romania and Poland. Have we approached the borders of the US or Britain? They have approached ours, and now they say Ukraine will also be a NATO member.
Prominent Russian journalists who have worked in the presidential pool for 20 years believe that Putin's statements serve as a deterrent against the West.
It seems to me that he should not be fascinated by anything for a long time, but he himself sets the vector of many agreements, follows a path that is sometimes completely unexpected for many, hinting that if it is ignored, then retaliatory actions will follow. And since no one knows what they can be, they start to get scared. This is a deterrent.
Speaking about Ukraine, Putin said that Russia was responding to threats from Kyiv. He said Kyiv does not want to honor the Minsk agreements and adopts laws that run counter to these accords. Putin said Ukraine and the West want to portray Russia as a party of a conflict in that country. He said incumbent Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been under the influence of radical elements after coming to power, like the country's previous leaders.
There must be tension for the hegemon to change. The hegemon, which is America and the English-speaking world, will not just give itself up. But this hegemon does not have enough strength, and we are watching it trying to enter into negotiations.
On Afghanistan, Putin stated that Afghanistan needs a government that represents its entire people so it can be recognized by the international community. He asserted that the countries that occupied Afghanistan for two decades should be the first to offer aid. He called on the West to unfreeze Afghanistan's financial assets, warning that the country is on the brink of famine.
Putin holds a big press conference every year in December, during which the president often touches on acute international problems and suggests ways to solve them. The statements made by the Russian president during this event are prompted by politicians from different countries, in particular by the opponents of Russia. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, 'tis the season to be jolly is a song which commemorates Christmas, but anything but jolly is the way the people of this land, Palestinians, feel as they are under continued attack. Birka, near Nablus, the city 2 hours away from Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, has been the scene of increased settler violence accompanied by Israeli forces against the Palestinian people. It was supposed to be a holy night, but instead Birka witnessed at least 250 Palestinians being wounded. Well, what would Jesus say about what regularly occurs now in the land where he was born?
Israel is stepping up its acts of violence against Palestinians with impunity. Attacks by settlers have grown more audacious recently. In the latest incident, over 250 Palestinian protesters were injured in an Israeli attack on the village of Birka near Nablus in the occupied West Bank that happened late Sunday. From live rounds and tear gas to rubber bullets and stun grenades, the Israeli forces fired everything they could to ward off the Palestinian protesters. It all started when the Israeli army moved in, deploying soldiers to the Nablus-Jenin road to secure dozens of buses packed with settlers. They also closed off the entrance to the village of Burqa, and that infuriated the Palestinians and triggered protests. In recent days, Burqa has been a flashpoint of clashes. Israeli settlers with protection from the army have attempted to raid Palestinian houses there. In a separate accident that happened a few days ago, an Israeli settler ran over a Palestinian woman, killing her near Ramallah in the northern West Bank. It came just hours after settlers attacked a nearby village that rapidly escalated into a round of violence, with Israeli troops firing rubber bullets and tear gas and injuring at least 125 Palestinians. Pro-Palestinian activist Paul Lorodi believes that Tel Aviv is seeking a policy of isolating Palestinians and forcing them out of their homes.
But the strategy of the Israelis has been to surround large cities like Nablus, as they did in Qarqilia, and to isolate them and to destroy their economy and to basically to force Palestinians to find work elsewhere.
The atrocities go on, but the international community remains silent. That has raised criticisms that the lack of global reaction to the situation in fact gives the green light to the Israeli regime to continue with its unjust policies. Even the UN has lashed out at the world community for remaining tight-lipped in the face of the Israeli crimes. UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Link, says the international community must hold Israel accountable for its occupation of Palestine. He says Tel Aviv is refusing to comply with the UN resolutions, including UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which calls for an end to settlement expansion in the occupied territories. Anti-war activist Ken Stone believes a concerted international effort is needed to tackle the situation.
Behind the colonial project in Palestine is the might of the U.S. empire. And the U.S. and its allies, including, unfortunately, Canada, enable this kind of mistreatment of the Palestinians.
Palestinians are witnessing bolder and more violent attacks with each passing day, and they are waiting to see when the international community will finally move to stop the injustice.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist and political analyst out of London, and Dawood Khotab, award-winning Palestinian journalist out of Amman.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, welcome both of you to the program. Hafsa, I want to start off a little bit different this time because perhaps it's the season. But in general, you know, in Western media especially, they never talk about the Christian-Palestinian side of things as if there are no Christian Palestinians. I want to talk about this because actually more and more Christian Palestinians, the leaders have warned that their community is under threat of violence as the settler violence has also increased against them. Your take on this and why we see this not being talked about, and even we know there's a big Christian Zionist community in the West, especially in the United States, that's very pro-Zionist regime.
Well, there are two aspects. First of all, I think Christian faith and Christian spirituality and Christian values have been almost erased from Western culture and society, and therefore everything that Christmas stands for has actually been taken out of its essence and turned into a sort of a capitalist fest that almost represents everything that Jesus opposed. So I think in that respect you can almost understand the context in which there is no longer any humanity, no longer any wish to express solidarity with the oppressed of this world, which is what Jesus's message was all about. So that's the spiritual element. On the other element, of course, is that the media, the Zionist media, is very much in control of a media outlet, and therefore they simply refuse to broadcast information that shows the suffering of Christians. Because, of course, if you all remember when we had ISIS, for instance, targeting Yazidis or Christians, that was all over the news, and rightly so, obviously, because this terrorist organization was targeting Christians. But when these Zionists, when you have Jewish extremists that are insulting and defaming the Virgin Mary, writing graffitis on churches, and then taking it a step further and massacring Palestinians and destroying their celebrations, you have no coverage whatsoever in the mainstream media, as if those Christians absolutely have no value in the eyes of other fellow Christians. So you see actually in this response and in this reaction of Western media the hold Zionist organizations have on mainstream outlets. And this is why Christians are not reacting to this horror, because they're simply not informed about it.
Well, Dawood, why do you think that we have seen this increase in violence by the Israeli regime recently in general? I mean, it's violent in general, but there has been definitely even more exaggerated than normal.
Well, you know that when there is no political horizon for people, they are frustrated. You know, right now, the Israeli prime minister said to the U.S. president, there will be no talks, there will be no meeting with the Palestinian leadership, and there will be no two-state solution. So the three no's that the Arabs said in 1967 are now become Israeli no's, and the Israelis are not interested in peace or even in negotiations. So without peace, without negotiations, the level of frustration because of the lack of horizon is quite high, and so people are basically left to fight for themselves, to defend themselves. And we're going to have a very bloody year if there isn't any genuine intervention. The U.S. is already giving lip service to the fact that they're against the settler violence. I think we need much more than that. I think we need an international force, a peace force, to step in, because the Israeli army is not a neutral party. The Israeli army, as the Israeli human rights organizations have said, are part of the problem. They are part of the strategic Israeli long-term plan of removing or weakening the Palestinian presence in Palestine.
Well, what do you think about that, Hafsa, what Dawood said, that what's needed is an international force to intervene here? What's your thought about that?
I mean, in absolute terms, why not? Anything that could stop the bloodshed and the suffering of Palestinians and also limit the use of force by Israeli forces would be something to be welcomed. But of course, Israeli lobbies actually have a strict control of major international institutions, mainly the UN, which in itself is highly reliant on US funds and support, and therefore abides by whatever Israel wants to do. So it's highly unlikely that all the Israelis have to do is simply say no, they won't have international forces, and we won't see international forces. In particular, there will always be a reason why those forces won't be accepted. The Arabs will be seen as biased, so they won't have Arabs. Those Arabs that have normalized will be refused for other reasons. From African countries, they'll be seen as perhaps having some sort of solidarity against colonization. So the Israelis will find any excuse to oppose it, and I think they will simply get their way by not having an international force. Picking up on my co-panelist's point about the Israelis, no. I think we also have to remember, very sadly, that the recent normalizations by Arab countries has almost sort of emboldened Israel, because, of course, why should they concede anything now, since they keep having the cake and eating it? They have the unconditional support of Europe, they have the unconditional support of the US, and of course more recently they've managed to normalize with nothing in return with many Arab countries, and therefore they have really no reason to negotiate any form of peace treaty with the Palestinians, because all the cards so far are sadly in their hands. Of course, Palestinian resistance is still the only option, and sadly that's going to cost lives, but that is the only way forward for the Palestinian cause.
Well, Hafsa, actually, you answered my next question about that, Dawood, what I was going to say about Israel being emboldened by what has happened with the culpability of these Arab regimes. I want your perspective. How big of a role, Dawood, has this played in making the regime even more aggressive?
Well, I think the Israelis are caught because they are stuck in a situation where theoretically, they dream of controlling all of the Palestinian areas, but they have a semblance of attempt to have a difference between the army and the settlers. In reality, we all know that there is no difference between settlers and the army. Each has different roles to play, but they both are on the same side. And we have seen pictures and videos, many of Israeli soldiers giving their guns to the settlers, protecting the settlers, and basically enabling them. So I think it's very embarrassing to the Israeli army that they are unable to control their own population, settler population. And I think they all know that the Israeli government is a settler government. It's led by a former head of the settlement movement. And they will not be punished. They will not be held accountable for their actions. You know, they've burnt farms. They've cut down a lot of trees. They've desecrated homes, as well as what my colleague said, churches, and attacked religious people. So the settler violence is being held with impunity. There is no reason for them to stop it. And the army does not have the courage or the ability or the will to stop the settler violence. So I don't know if it's being encouraged by the army, but certainly it's not being discouraged by the army.
Hafsa, your perspective, how big of a role do you see these Western governments playing in all of this? Because you talked about the United Nations before, and we look at the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France. I mean, we just name and we go on. Would the Israelis be this emboldened and arrogant if these governments actually put pressure on them, or were not as supportive as they are?
Oh, absolutely not. I think Israel would collapse as a project if it wasn't upheld with the money from the US, with the political support from everywhere. We keep hearing that it's, you know, a startup country with all sorts of amazing things and technological advancement, but absolutely all these things have been made possible with the unconditional support and funds coming from the West, and also the means to support it, i.e. not taxing goods coming from Israel, allowing imports, giving sort of freeway imports for Israeli goods, and so allowing Israeli businesses to flourish when these relationships don't exist with other countries. So Project Israel would not exist had it not been for this unconditional support of the US and Western countries. But of course, the relationship has slightly sort of changed over the past, because originally Israel was sort of created as an outpost to serve Western interests in the heart of the Arab world. But over the years, through Zionist, very powerful and very well-funded Zionist organization, you have these organizations that have started buying, in essence, politicians from across these many influential countries. And therefore, what has happened is you have these very influential politicians, whether in Washington, whether in Canada, in the UK, in France, etc. They are in the heart of the political establishment, and they are there, funded by Israel, only to serve Israeli interests. So what happens is you have in the heart of these very powerful countries groups that are not, that do not have the interests of their fellow citizens at heart, but rather Israel. And so you now have Israel literally controlling perhaps is a big word, but actually having incredible influence at the top echelons of Western political power.
Well, does the Israeli regime, does it actually think it's invincible that we see this increase in violence? Or is it that it is increasingly afraid of dealing with the Palestinians and losing its grip over them?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, Israel is an occupying power that's depending almost totally on the military might of the Israeli army, protecting the Jewish settlers, but also using all kinds of levers, intelligence levers and economic levers, to keep the Palestinians at bay and quiet and so on. It's not working. It's not working because Mahmoud Abbas is unable to, or unwilling, or not interested in becoming the policeman of the Israelis, now that the Israelis are also cutting off some of the funds that are supposed to come to the Palestinians, which are taxes that Israel collects for the Palestinians. So the Israelis have to carry out their own security to a certain degree. Now, they're still on the big issues. The Palestinian police will probably prevent any major attacks on Israel or bombings. But on day-to-day things, especially in the settlement area, the Palestinians are rather united on the ground in opposing any kind of a settler violence or attempts to rebuild any settlement postings or housing or whatever. So, it's not a very easy situation for the Israelis. Now, so far, they basically had it easy. They have not suffered any financial or human cost for the occupation. And I think this is the key to the end of the occupation, is once the occupation costly in human terms or financial terms or other terms, that's when we will see a change in Israel.
Perhaps the Palestinian Authority is calling for the international community to intervene and stop Israeli aggression. Your thoughts about that, and why does the PA still look toward the so-called international community when clearly very little has been done by the UN for Palestine since Israel's establishment?
Yes, that's actually a good question, to which I'm not sure I have an actual answer, but I do know that the PA, and especially under Mahmoud Abbas, has been absolutely dire in pushing the Palestinian narratives in a positive way, and in an effective way, in major Western capitals. It has literally become almost, I mean, the al-Fatah and the security apparatus almost does Israel's dirty work. It hasn't done anything towards reconciliation with Hamas. It continues to almost serve Israeli interests more than it serves the Palestinian cause. And so therefore, the Israelis are actually quite happy to have Mahmoud Abbas in place, because he's not really doing anything for the Palestinian cause. And you would have expected that he's been in power now for many years. He's a rather elderly gentleman. And the decent thing to do would have been to step down and let a new leadership take over. Fresh blood, a new discourse, something that would be more palatable across media, across the world. But he's not doing that simply because the Israelis want him to remain, because he's simply not acting in the interest of the Palestinian people.
Well, Dawood, I mean, if 250 people had been injured anywhere else in the world, it would make headlines, but that doesn't seem to be the case with Palestinians when dealing with corporate media. Little or nothing is being said about this. I mean, 250 people being injured in one night is absolutely astonishing. Your assessment of this and what needs to change?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. There's one way which says that there's international exhaustion of the Palestinian issue. They've been covering it for a while, and unless there's, a lot of deaths involved, if it bleeds, it bleeds type of thing. But they are bleeding, and yet still they're not paying attention. So it's hard to answer that question on the eve of Christmas and the Christmas activities, as you said in your introduction, 2 hours away from the birth of Christ. Are all these injuries happening, and yet the media totally ignored what's happening? This is the problem we have had for a while.
Well, doesn't it show the hypocrisy of it all? On the one hand, they could be having major coverage of Christmas, and then on the other hand, 2 hours away from where Jesus was born, all of this violence is taking place simultaneously.
They're not interested. They're not interested in a bad story on Christmas Eve. They want to give people some positive stories in their own eyes, and they, it's very convenient for the pro-Israeli media to stay away from stories of bloodshed or attacks, and certainly of the Israelis, because they still are basically upholden to what they call a Judeo-Christian attitude, which, they remember in Sunday school about Jesus and Bethlehem and so on. The last thing they want to do is show the Israelis shooting at Palestinian civilians. But this is a reality, and the media is basically, as you said, they are being hypocrites to their own oath, to their own media guidelines that says that you should cover things like this, and at least give the balance, say there is something happening in Bethlehem and Christmas, but you know, also in Palestine, people are being denied to live freely and are being attacked because some radical Jewish settlers want to march in the middle of a Palestinian community. So, yes, that is hypocrisy, but it's not the first time.
Well, Hafsa, Palestinians have been more united than ever. I mean, if we look at the resistance this year, has this phase, would you say this has entered a new intifada or not?
I don't know. We've had this point before about the new intifada. I think now it's kind of, there is fatigue on all sides. If I can just pick up on one point about the Christian element of mm-hmm. what's happening now, I think we also have to underline the absolute failure of Christian churches across the world in failing to report this and to make adequate condemnation. As I said at the beginning, had it been Islamists attacking churches or places of worship at one of the most sensitive times of the Christian calendar, it would have been widespread coverage, and you would have heard the major Christian authorities, figure of authority, actually reacting to this. So we also, in the same way that we often pinpoint the Muslim clerics when they fail in certain aspects, etc., I think we also have to hold the Christian authorities responsible for the absolute and abject failure in condemning this violence and these desecrations that are occurring in the Holy Land and on the holiest of days for Christians. Picking up, sorry, on your point about...
Well, it's okay. Let me get Dawood in. Let me get Dawood in, actually, because I only have a couple of minutes left. Dawood, at this point in time, is there anything but resistance that will lead to some type of answer for the Palestinians? You said in the very beginning there's the three no's. So if it's no for negotiations, no for basically anything, as you were saying, do they have any choice but to resist?
No, I don't think Palestinians have any much choice, because they, unfortunately, Israel and probably the world only understands things when there is continuous resistance. Now, I'm not in favor of military resistance, but I think nonviolent popular resistance is something that has to be done. It's the only way that you continue to keep the hot, if you will. Even if the media doesn't cover it, sooner or later there will be coverage. And I think, yes, we are entering in a phase. I think 2022 is going to be a very chaotic year. There will be a lot of bloodshed because the Israelis have no political plan. They have no strategy. And without a strategy, that basically means the population, 5 million Palestinians or more, have no hope, have no aspiration. They don't see their leaders meeting and having negotiations and to give some hope. And, you know, we're Christmas time. It's a time of giving people hope, peace on earth, goodwill to all people. We don't see that. And without the peace on earth and without goodwill, the frustration will be very high.
All right. Well, I'd like to get Hafsa back in here, but I'm out of time. Unfortunately, appreciate both of you being with me on the spotlight. Hafsa Kara Mostafa, journalist and political analyst out of London, and Dawood Qutab, award-winning Palestinian journalist out of Amman. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com,
ISRAEL.org/EN. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. And this is the sender's address. This is the receiver's address, who is my cousin's address. And this is the subject of the email. And now the enter's key. Finished. Well, we're living in the era of speed and technology, and in my idea, it's a really good era. Typing and sending this email just took 5 minutes, and my cousin, who lives in Germany, received my message in seconds. If it was 50 years ago, she must have waited for weeks to receive my message. Today, we are going to visit Tehran's Post and Communications Museum. Stay with me. Iranians of Achaemenid era, by establishing Chaparkhane, literally courier house, opened the first postal service in the world. Greek historian Herodotus writes about the postal system in Iran. There is nothing that travels faster and yet is mortal than these couriers. The Persians invented this system, which works as follows. It is said that there are as many horses and men posted at intervals as there are days required for the entire journey, so that one horse and one man are assigned to each day. And neither snow nor rain nor heat nor dark of night keeps them from completing their appointed course as swiftly as possible. Initially, Tehran's Post and Communications Museum was opened in 1932 as part of the Ministry of Post and Telegraph. This building, which was located at southern part of Imam Khomeini Square, was dismantled in 1970. The current building of the museum was constructed, inspired by the national architecture, and is one of the outstanding structures of the area of Tehran's National Garden. I am now standing beside the building of Tehran's Post and Communications Museum. This building once used to be called the post office. Several different materials have been used in this big, beautiful building. Stone, brick, and wood. It has also a gabled roof. Let's go inside to see what's going on there. Thank you. Post and Communications Museum is a two-story building along with a basement. There are 8 chambers in each floor which have been allocated for a certain subject. I am now on the first floor of the museum. This chamber is ceremonial and for the ministerial level. Photos of 72 ministers since past till now have been showcased in this chamber. And this chamber consists of postal staff. Different post boxes from Iran and other countries are here. It's very interesting. And here, there are the uniforms of postmen. And in this part of the chamber, you can see seals by which postage stamps were revoked. And I am now in the Chamber of Silk Road. Here, all the communications staff of the past time till today have been showcased. On my right, there is a chariot with a horse. And in this part of the chamber, there is a small vehicle with 3 wheels, which has this riding post. And on the other side, you can see a replica of an airplane. However, these days, drones are used for sending mails. I am now on the second floor. Here there is a big hall called the Hall of International Stamps. Here there are stamps from 130 countries. Oh, look at the showcases. Inside the showcases, you can see sealed envelopes which have been donated to this museum by well-known or outstanding figures. Ah, good old days. My father gave me a stamp album when I was 8. I take a look at my grandma's basement this time. Maybe I can't find my album there. Perhaps my stamp album has become precious during these years and I can donate it to the museum. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning!
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.